Hello, this is Mark Peacock, and welcome to the Travel Commons Podcast. This is Travel Commons Podcast number 109, recorded Saturday, June 7th, 2014. This is the podcast giving the voice of the traveler. It's more about the journey than the destination. Two topics on this edition of the Travel Commons Podcast, Around the World in 8 Days, and Beijing Mass Transit. We're coming to you again from the Travel Commons studios outside of Chicago, and I say again because this is the second crack at recording this episode. I actually ran all the way yesterday, Friday, ran all the way through recording this episode. I listened to the audio as I was going into production, and it just sounded like crap. So, if you think this sounds like crap, just imagine how bad the last one sounded if I dumped an entire episode. So anyhow, we're going to take a podcast mulligan and start again. So anyhow, I am back on my normal commute, Chicago to New Orleans, kind of with the odd stop every once in a while in Memphis, after a couple of big Asian trips in April and May. Now, I talked a bit about my Beijing trip in the last episode, and then at the beginning of this month, I ended up flying around the world in 8 days, flash travel for meetings in India and in Manila in the Philippines. As you can imagine, it took me a couple of weeks to recover from that trip. That amount of airtime, and I added it up, pulled out the itinerary, added up all the flight times, 44 hours in the air. That was a push even for me. And I mean, as I've spoken on the podcast before, I mean, I've regularly done up and backs, day trips between Chicago and San Francisco. And you might remember, a few episodes a few years ago where I talked about doing an up and back to London, where I left Chicago on the overnight flight to Heathrow, showered, changed in the airline club, took a car out to Reading for a lunch meeting, then headed back to Heathrow in time to pick up the afternoon flight back to Denver. I mean, I got to tell you, that had been my most stupid piece of travel until this one. This one, I think this one aged me in dog years. Following up, back in December in my top 10 travel tips article, which I tend to do sort of every other year, I tend to update it every other year, I talked about using Twitter as a concierge service. I suggested at naming, an airline or a hotel in the tweet, which then I found tends to generate, at least with airlines, a response within a couple of minutes. However, I got to tell you, in the 5 months since I made that recommendation, I've seen the quality and the usefulness of those responses degrade, almost exponentially. At naming United almost inevitably results in some cut and pasted pre-approved apology. Sorry, we hate delays as much as you do. Or our apologies for the delay in your travel. Safety is our utmost priority. And I'll tell you, to that last one, I then responded back, oh, stop. If you were concerned about safety, you'd spend more on preventive maintenance to avoid these delays in the first place. That at naming, that generated nothing but silence. Delta's Twitter account, on the other hand, did quickly solve a problem for me that I couldn't figure out anywhere. I'd mentioned in an earlier episode that I just have hated having to fly Delta because I couldn't get TSA PreCheck. And, facing down another Delta flight out of New Orleans, I thought I might try one more time to fix it. I found what I thought was the right Delta Twitter handle, at Delta Assist, and tweeted them with the message, how do I get my global traveler number associated with my Delta profile so I can get pre-check for my New Orleans to Detroit flight tomorrow? Now remember, because I had done global traveler when it first came out, I've got that number. And so I qualify for pre-check really on any airline that'll take it, as opposed to having to qualify, having to be, some sort of status, which I'm not on Delta. Well, anyhow, a couple minutes later, I got this reply, please DM me with your info and I'll proceed. Within 10 minutes, it was done. He'd gotten the person at the other end of Twitter, he'd gotten everything plugged in. And so when I checked in then 30 minutes later using the Delta smartphone app, there was that pre-check symbol on the boarding pass. So perhaps that usefulness decay in Twitter responses is airline specific. I don't know, perhaps there's some direct connection with United's low score on the latest J.D. Power's customer satisfaction survey. Yeah, I think that probably has something to do with it. As I've mentioned many times in this podcast, Bose noise-canceling headphones are the mark of a true road warrior. Sure, you might see some new Gen Y analyst types sporting Beats, or, you know, you got some audiophile wearing some big Sennheiser cans, but still, by and far, Bose is number one. But they're expensive. $300, and they're never on sale, not even at the Bose outlet stores. And so about once every 6 months, I had this conversation, the same conversation with somebody sitting next to me on the plane. Hey, nice Bose. Do you like your Bose? Yep, I think they're great. Yeah, I'd love to get a pair, but they're so damn expensive. That's the exchange almost word for word every 6 months, right down to the damn in front of expensive. And here's what I tell them. No one ever buys Bose headphones for cash. Nobody, not me, nobody I know. That's what membership miles are for. Now, if you're traveling on business, odds are that you have a corporate Amex card on which you are racking up membership miles for, you know, from spending on plane tickets and hotel bills, and you don't quite know what to do with them. What you do is splurge on travel luxuries for yourself, like Bose headphones. Hey, they're your miles. You suffered to earn them. Go on, get a little something for yourself that'll make that middle seat a little bit more bearable. But whatever you do, don't tell your spouse about them. They'll want to buy something sensible for the house. So instead, first you buy the Bose. After that, you know, maybe one of those good-looking Road Warrior Tumi carry-ons. And then one last travel technology bit. Finally, as I've threatened for many episodes, I ditched my iPhone 5 for an HTC One Android phone. I just got completely fed up with the lousy, unpredictable battery life on the iPhone 5 after I upgraded to iOS 7. Now, I don't know, maybe iOS 8 that Apple announced this week will fix things, but I waited as long as I could. I just got tired of being psychotic about battery life, about making sure I topped off my battery before boarding a plane, and then watching the battery meter drop 10% in the time, you know, that it took us to taxi from the runway. So, you know, we touch down, I power up the phone. I see a 10% drop between touchdown and getting to the gate. It was just not being able to get away from a charging cable for more than 2 hours. Now, I'm not a stranger to Android. I've used a Google Nexus 7 for a couple of years and a Samsung tablet before that. But, you know, so I'm comfortable with Android. Indeed, I've said on past episodes that I prefer Android tablets to iPads because I can do more with them, sort of get to the directory structure, attach files to emails. I mean, for me, the Android tablets are closer or get me closer to a PC replacement than iPads. But phones are different. Using it to talk and text is more important than editing a document. Now, I'd been on iOS since the iPhone 3G, so this is a big change. Android hides settings in different places from iOS, the calendar acts different, the dialer acts different, so it's been a learning experience. But, you know, with Android, there is a bit more choice. I mean, right now, I've got, say, 4 mail apps on my phone right now that I'm running in parallel, figuring out which one I like best, and then I'll blow away the other 3. I gotta say also that I'm very happy to get rid of that lousy iPhone podcast player app. That thing just drove me up a wall. I've got a couple versions that I'm running on Android that, again, I'm running them, you know, doing a side-by-side test on. But of course, as I said before, I mean, the thing that drove me to change was the battery life. And this is the most important thing, and it's working out. It's been the right decision. I'm no longer waiting to the last minute to board the plane, trying to push that iPhone battery meter up one last percentage point. And with the bigger screen, you know, 5 inches on the HTC versus 4 on the iPhone 5, I find myself reading more stuff on my phone and leaving my tablet in my backpack more often. I'm still tweaking things, but I'm very satisfied with that change. Hey, and if you've got any travel experiences, technology or otherwise, just some general observations, thoughts, questions, a story, comment, a travel tip, the voice of the traveler, send it along. The email address, comments, COMMENTS on travelcommons.com, or you can use your smartphone, either iPhone or Android, to record and send in an audio comment. Send a Twitter message to M. Peacock, or you can post your thoughts on the Travel Commons Facebook page. Or you can always go old school and post your thoughts on the website at travelcommons.com. First topic on today's Travel Commons podcast is round the world in 8 days. You know, I think it's a given that your mind is more of a barrier to doing something than your body is. I mean, I always surprise myself when once I've pushed through what I thought was a major barrier, how sort of normal or ordinary it seems to be on the other side. I do that with road biking all the time, thinking a 50-mile ride or a 100-kilometer ride or a 100-mile ride is a big deal until I do it that first time. You know, flight times, I think, are that way, too. Early in my career, I remember thinking that the 3 to 4 hours from Chicago to California, that was a huge flight. And that the 14 hours it would take me to fly to Tokyo was just inconceivable. But then I flew, you know, after a couple of years of working, I flew 7 hours to London. Then, you know, some years later, 10 hours from Europe to South Africa. And then the big jump, 17 hours from New York to Joburg, and I did that every 6 weeks for a project. Now, with that experience under my belt, that 14-hour flight time to Tokyo or India or China was no longer unthinkable, just long. So when a project schedule and then the May Day holiday forced me to compress trips to India and Manila into a single week, you know, I took a deep breath and thought, well, what the hell? So cutting H.G. Wells' time by an order of magnitude, my itinerary took me around the world in 8 days. Chicago to Newark to Delhi to Bangalore to Singapore to Manila to Tokyo to Chicago. As I said before, 44 hours of flight time. That's in the air time. Doesn't count wait time or layover time. 44 hours at 39,000 feet in a week. I left Chicago Saturday afternoon, touched down in Delhi Sunday night. I was fine on Monday and Tuesday. There wasn't much downtime. We were meeting people pretty much straight through from sort of 7 a.m. breakfast to dinners that ended at 11 o'clock at night. I kind of think people would have followed me into the toilet if I didn't give them a stern look. Wednesday, though, we just absolutely hit the wall. But because of the impending May Day holiday shutdown, we just couldn't stop. We had to push through. So we just doubled down on caffeine consumption and kind of gritted our teeth. Because we had a break on Thursday, which was May Day, May 1st, while everyone was celebrating the workers' holiday, we hopped Singapore Air to Manila. Now, Sing Air is always at the top of any list of the best business class cabins. And unfortunately, though, I can't opine on that because I think I slept all but, say, 45 minutes of the 7 to 8 hours I spent in Sing Air business class, which I think really kind of frustrated the flight attendants. They kept trying to give me food and drinks whenever I opened my eyes. I would just sort of wave them off and just say, yeah, just some more water. And then I'd roll over and go back to sleep. Now, at the end of it, then that following Saturday when I was flying home, all of my Manila to Chicago flight options connected through Tokyo. Now, I could have flown United, but I don't know. I'm on a bit of a United strike right now. I'm just not happy with how many delays and cancellations I've taken from them. So I decided to try a new airline and flew ANA, All Nippon Airways. I'd never flown a Japanese airline before, so I thought, hey, okay, well, this will be something new. And since they're one of the first airlines to buy a 787 Dreamliner, I was kind of hoping one of those would show up on my route. You know, no luck with that, though. It was 777s on both legs. But what was fun was mealtime. The menu had two sides, a Japanese menu and an international menu, kind of American and European food. So I figured I'd go Japanese, eat as local as possible as you can at 39,000 feet. And I guess I was a little disconcerted when I saw most of the Japanese passengers ordering the international menu. But hey, here we go. It turned out fine for me. half the value in my mind of airplane meals, especially in long haul flights, is the distraction, kind of the entertainment value. A good business class meal service should keep you occupied for at least an hour between perusing the menu, choosing a wine, having the meal coursed out to you, and then the dessert trolley comes along, and then the after-dinner liqueur trolley comes along. Now, the Japanese meal was really the best ever I think I've had at that entertainment value. Every tray they put down in front of me had at least, I don't know, 6 to 8 little cups or boxes of plates or food on it, none of which I really recognized. And, you know, I eat Japanese food pretty regularly when I'm on the road. So they'd put the tray down, I'd look at it, then I'd look through the menu and try to match each line on the menu with one of the boxes or cups in front of me. Now, not all of them were easy. I'd need to kind of take a taste maybe and go, oh, well, that's the custard with the snow crab. But it was really great because sort of the menu matching kept me even more occupied than normal. It was lots of fun. And actually, the food was pretty good, too. Now, of course, when you travel to a new country, there's always something that can trip you up. Now, I've traveled to India a number of times over the past 3 to 4 years, so I've gotten to know some of the eccentricities, like needing a physical printout of your itinerary to even get into an airport terminal, and sort of the separate men and women security lines because every passenger gets wanded and patted down after passing through the metal detector. I mean, I got to tell you that the Indian security, I mean, it makes TSA pre-check seem like your morning walk has been momentarily interrupted by a couple of nice mall cops. But the Philippines were new to me. I mean, we landed at Manila at 11 p.m. Thursday night. Immigration was a bit of a goat rodeo, and the ride to the hotel felt like we were passing through some, you know, sort of just this side of dodgy parts of L.A. But it was much more normal than our first night in Delhi. Now, the way out was where the bump showed up. First is the exit tax. They like to call it an airport fee, but you can't leave until you pay it, so kind of feels a lot like an exit tax. It was 500 pesos, which I think is around 14 bucks, in cash. Not a big thing if you know about it ahead of time, which I almost didn't. We were having some beers before dinner Friday night. Somebody asked some question about the Manila airport. I don't remember the question, but none of us knew the answer. So, of course, everybody whips out the smartphones and, you know, revs up Google. And somewhere on one of the web pages I was scanning after that, I saw a comment about the exit tax. Like, whoa! And so we, like, pick up, run over to the concierge. Yep, it's true. Now, I had 750 pesos on me from an earlier trip to the ATM, so I was good with it. But the other guys didn't have any Filipino currency. But what they got was the front desk to give them, you know, 500 pesos in cash and then charge that to their hotel room so they didn't have to go and, you know, search out an ATM. So, you know, crisis averted. The thing that did catch me, though, was the sign at the check-in desk Saturday morning saying portable umbrellas were prohibited in carry-ons. Wait, what? I've carried this bag on 3/4 of the way around the world, and now I have to check it because I got a 10-inch totes umbrella in the front pocket? I mean, did the security guys watch too much Batman when they were growing up, and now they're having flashbacks to when the Penguin used a machine gun umbrella? I mean, this is a country where it dumps rain every afternoon, so you really need an umbrella. But from the look on the agent's face, I could tell, yes, it's for real, and no, I don't agree with it either. So I reluctantly checked my bag and headed off to security, where none of the security screeners seemed to be paying any attention to any other security signage. I mean, in spite of signs to the contrary, I was waved off from taking my PC out of the bag or taking my blazer off. I mean, could I have sneaked my lethal totes through? Yeah, probably, but I had just paid the airport exit tax, and I just wanted to get on the plane so I could go back to sleep. The second topic on today's Travel Commons podcast is Beijing Mass Transit. Now, one of the things I didn't get to in the last episode when I was talking about our April trip to Beijing was to report out on mass transit. It's been an ongoing thread in the Travel Commons podcast, probably for the past couple of years, about getting around in cities without a car. I did videos for Frankfurt and Chicago. I've talked about Portland, San Francisco, Amsterdam. So let's add Beijing to the mix. So when we landed in Beijing, we got on the other side of customs at the airport late. I don't know, 10:30, 11 p.m. local time, after what was after a 14-hour flight. And we saw signs for an airport express, but since it was late, we just couldn't figure out the particulars of the airport express. Most importantly, where would it drop us in relation to our hotel? And then compared that with the cab fare, which when I looked it up online, estimated it'd only be about, after the translation, about $15. Just figured, forget it. We just headed toward the cab line, which then offered its own kind of challenges. The line overflowed the regular switchback corral, those zigzags that you see in Disneyland, and then tailed back past a sign that said 60-minute wait from here. Well, that was great. And then there were what they call black cabs, non-licensed guys, walking up and down the back end of the line, soliciting, some aggressively, some multiple times, soliciting rides. But when I saw the locals, blowing the guys off, then I just did the same. Now, a couple of times, the airport police ended up walking down the line, down toward the end of the line where we were, and you could just see the black cab guys just run off. I mean, literally, just boom, bolt. Though we did see a couple of guys sort of try to melt into the line, kind of standing behind a concrete pillar out of the cop's line of sight. I mean, in the end, though, the line wasn't bad. 20 minutes and we were at the front of the line, which then meant we could have our first experience with the hassle of dealing with Beijing cab drivers. They're picky and incredibly argumentative. And of course, since they're arguing in Chinese, a language that I don't speak, it can be a challenge to actually get going anywhere. Now, at the airport, the cab rank people waved me, toward a cab. Now, I had printed out the directions in Chinese of the Marriott from their website, complete with a small map. I showed it to the cab driver. He took the paper, looked a bit puzzled, showed it to another guy, who then tried to wave me over to his car, a black cab, while my assigned cab driver just sort of wandered away looking up and, having a smoke. Now, I went back to the cab, I just waved off that black cab guy, went back to the cab rank guy, showed him the directions, then he comes over, starts yelling at the cab driver, at the original cab driver, which finally got him to start loading our bags into the cab. I tell you, this scene would be repeated almost every time we caught a cab from our hotel. We'd have the concierge book us a table at a restaurant, have him write the address and directions out in Chinese characters. We'd show it to the cab driver, who would then look puzzled and start arguing with the doorman. One time, I had to pull up Google Maps and do a bit of a pantomime with the cab driver. Look, here's where we want to go, before he would head off. I mean, the only thing worse than this was trying to hail a cab in town. Cabs would have their available sign showing in the window, but then would wave me off when I tried to hail them. It would usually take, 3 to 5 attempts before one stopped. But then, about half of them wouldn't want to take us where we wanted to go. I tell you, I've had better luck getting a cab from Midtown Manhattan to LaGuardia in the rain during rush hour than I had getting a taxi in Beijing. So it made perfect sense when I read TripAdvisor's survey a couple of weeks ago saying that Beijing was second only to Moscow as the worst city for taxi service, which really made us appreciate how great the Beijing subway is. It's cheap, clean, modern. There's station announcements in Chinese and English. I guess this is a legacy from the 2008 Summer Olympics. But we took it all the time. Now, the only downside is it's jammed. So you think the London Tube at rush hour is crowded? The Chicago Red Line during a Cubs home game? Nothing. They got nothing on subway riding in Beijing. It's a full contact sport. But, with 25 million people in the city, I'm not sure I should be surprised. I think I sat down in the subway car once in all the rides I took. But even crowded, it's a great system, except maybe for having to pass your bag through an x-ray machine before entering the station. But at least the Chinese didn't want to take away my umbrella. Okay, that's it. That's the end of Travel Commons Podcast 109. I hope you all enjoyed this podcast, and I hope you decide to stay subscribed. If you like the music, check out the show notes for links that you can click through to. And as always, if you have a story, thought, comment, gripe, the voice of the traveler, send them along, text or audio file to comments, COMMENTS at travelcommons.com, MPeacock on Twitter, write them down on the Travel Commons wall on Facebook. And if you go to the website at travelcommons.com, there's links to both Twitter and to the Facebook page. You can always post them then. And if you manage to find the Travel Commons website, you can always post comments there too underneath the show notes. Thanks to everyone who has taken the time to send emails, tweets, post comments on the website. Always helps. Always gives me content for the next episode. And until we speak again, safe travels, and thanks for stopping by the Travel Commons. Bye now.
On the road, life is hell. Strange bed in a lonely motel. But one thing needs my mind. The warm woman that I left behind. From California to Carolina, she calls me up and there's nothing finer. And when the tears start falling, crying into the phone, within my heart you'll find my pictures of you at home. No matter where life takes me, how many miles I've run.